Yeah, I'm Jackson. I have zero experience with carpentry.
I studied at a school for historic preservation in Boston and learned about how things were built, you know, 250 years ago.
There's a long way to go. I'm nowhere near the top. Not that I thought I was, but there's so much more to do out there.
Welcome back to the Passion for Craft podcast. We are continuing a fun series that we've been doing. Richard, I don't know how it's been for you. I feel like this has been one of the most beneficial series for myself. So selfishly, maybe for all the apprentices out there, this has been helpful.
Definitely. It has.
Yes. Okay. And Journeyman too, maybe. Doing a series called From the Ground Up. If you were to build this house style from the ground up, what would be some key identifying features? We have done four styles now. We've done ranch. We've done period revival.
Arts and crafts.
Oh, maybe we've just done three. This is our fourth.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I feel like this one is one that I am good at.
You are.
They're pretty obvious.
Nice.
If I was going to build a Victorian house, I think I would know a little bit versus the other ones.
Yeah. So we are doing Victorian today. That's the next from the ground up. Do you have the identifying features of a Victorian house? Like, what would you say as of right now?
The turret. That's one.
Okay.
For sure.
A large gun off the side of the house.
Yeah, machine gun.
Yeah.
That would be awesome. No.
The classic Victorian. Napoleon had made that.
Giant soffit brackets is another one.
What do you mean? Soffit brackets? What is that?
Right? Like the... On your eaves, you got those like scrolly brackets that come off.
Okay,
that
cool.
Seems really Victorian. Really tall. Mm-hmm. Really high. Those are just some off the top of the head.
Well, let's see if you're right.
Are any of those are right?
I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, but you could have a turret in a Tudor Revival house. You could have a turret in a French house. So that to me was a, you know, it
so
depends.
So maybe. One thing as we were just prepping for this, Brent said this has potential to be a two-part episode because there's so many Victorian. I was like, surely not. But after hearing all the categories of Victorian, I think there actually could be two episodes of this. So much like the period revival style, where if you remember when we went over that one, it has like different pockets that it can fall in, whether it's Italian, whether it's other stuff.
Tudor, Mediterranean, French, colonial, revival.
Yeah, you say them all.
Yeah.
You beat me to it.
So, yeah, I was actually about to say that. But much like that, we've got a bunch of categories. Is that correct, Brent?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
More than you want to even list.
How about you list them?
Well, I mean, so backing up, you didn't set this up very well.
Zero.
Part of the reason why we're doing this is because looking at houses today can be very confusing. And in my mind, everything has an historic precedent and goes back to a certain place in time. And so, like, the windows in the Victorian house, in my mind, are the distinctive feature, right? This 2/2 tall,
wow,
1/1 window. The proportions of a typical Victorian window are like 2 feet by 6 feet, right? Whereas an arts and crafts window is like 3 by 5. And so it's the proportions change. And so, you know, a lot of people try to build a Victorian house today and mess up the details, either because their ceilings aren't tall enough, you don't have the scale, you don't have the ornamentation. I mean, the other thing about Victorian architecture is ornamentation. So there's a bunch of junky, crappy ornamentation today that you know, is Victorian-esque because it's just kind of goopy and just kind of, you know, thrown together. And Victorian architecture, as that house right there, you know, indicates, is weird. Okay. It's just like, it's Frankenstein. And so, you know, the Victorian architecture is very similar to the McMansion period, in my opinion. You know, both periods have this newfound wealth. In the Victorian period, they have the Industrial Revolution and newfound wealth, growing middle class. In the McMansion era, you have the dot-com boom. You have, you know, just this, you know, the Wall Street greed, kind of just excessiveness. You have a number of manufacturing you know, advances taking place in the Victorian era. You have a lot of, in the McMansion era, you have a lot of composite materials being put together with glues and different things. Corian would be a good example of these newfangled, best new product kind of thing that is put together. You know, the whole idea about McMansion, right? Starter castle, you know, speaks to a house style that's over the top, that's tons of square footage, the most amount of square footage, least amount of money. You know, over the top design in the Victorian period tends to be the same way. So the whole setup.
Wait. Is Victorian most amount of square footage, least amount of money?
No.
That's McMansion. Got it.
Okay. And so, in any case, in my mind, we started doing this whole series because we wanted to help people identify and pick up on the clues of what those
people
but one of the clues about being a master builder in my mind is understanding historic precedent. And, you know, we're doing these styles so that you can understand what went on, what was happening, and so that you can look at new houses today and go, that detail doesn't work. You're trying to do a colonial revival house, but you have this, you know,
you have a super flat roof.
You have this Tudor window in there, or you have a flat roof, or you have the windows don't make sense, or whatever the thing is. And so it's developing that eye for, you know, how to achieve and how to make something beautiful and understanding the historic precedent in America. And so understanding these styles is really important.
So
that would be my setup.
Well, I'm glad you did it, not I.
So, I mean, you want me to list out these styles?
So just for reference, everyone, Brent did not know the styles offhand. He had to look them up.
So there's
we're all human.
Egyptian, okay.
Start with the E's.
Second Empire, Italianate, Romanesque, Tudor, Academic Gothic, Carpenter Gothic, Stick, Rustic Gothic, Folk Victorian. There's Colonial Revival. There is Tudor Revival. There's French Revival. There's probably 15 more. There's Beaux-Arts.
To clarify, Colonial Revival, Tudor Revival, French Revival are not period revival.
Correct. They take place like the Colonial Revival era, okay?
Yeah.
Starts in the 1870s, 1880s, which is the Victorian period, and lasts into the 1940s, 1950s. And so it sees an expression in the different period. The period revival era of the 1920s to 1940s is you know, let's start here. Why is it called the Victorian era?
Because they're mimicking Queen Victoria's.
England. No, well, Queen Victoria was the reigning monarch in England, and she and her husband, if you've ever been to England, go to the Victoria and Albert Museum. It's an incredible museum. They were very cutting edge. The Crystal Palace happened during their reign. They were about industrial might. They were about, you know, England at that time was the you know, chief major power in the world. America was coming, but wasn't there yet. And so the Victorian age is a way of expressing the zeitgeist of the age.
Zeitgeist?
Thank you. Yeah. Of the age, right? The expression of, you know, it was just after the Industrial Revolution. They had embraced the Industrial Revolution, engineering, steam engines, railroads, all those things that were part of that industrial growth. She was basically championed. Okay. Mm-hmm. Why are you laughing?
Just how you laugh at yourself mid sentence, like correcting yourself.
So it's called the Victorian age because she, you know, represented that ideal. Okay. Yeah. This embracing of technology. So that's why it's called Victorian. Okay.
She was in control of it.
Well, she just was the
pioneer
She was authority. Let's do this.
Well, what authority? Just kind of maybe the cheerleader for it, and so a lot of great things were happening in England, and so, you know, obviously we're still influenced by Britain at this time, and so it's called the Victorian Age, even though in America we have our own precedent. We're not Victorians, right? But the Victorian Age, And so Victorian architecture, therefore, is this expression. The reason why you have so many different styles in the Victorian age is because they're discovering new worlds. They're discovering, you know, the reason Egyptian revival becomes, you know, a style.
Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't a very influential style, but you do see Egyptian themes and Egyptian ornamentation and stuff is because of new discoveries in Egypt. I think Tutankhamun's grave was discovered during the Victorian era, and it was just this, wow, look at the world out there. Look what's going on. Oh, look at that.
No way.
And so you end up with these Egyptian details, Egyptian ornamentation that speaks to this excitement about this world that's just, you know, exploding in front of people, right? Mm-hmm. It's just that there's an excitement about the world around them, and so you have all these different styles going on.
It's cool.
Now, the way the Victorian era works in the U.S. is that you have, you know, Georgian Federal, Greek Revival, which lasts until the 1850s, even into the 1860s. I would say the Victorian era begins in America, 1860, 1870, 1880, really after the Civil War.
Yeah.
And so that's when you see this explosion, the city's explosion, these houses going on, stuff like that. Gothic Revival ends up being a little bit Victorian, only because it crosses over into it, into that age. And so you end up with these architectural styles that there are Greek Revival houses built in after 1860, but you wouldn't really call them Victorian. But because they don't have the ornamentation and everything else, they came from a different age, but they're built during that Victorian era. The Gothic Revival is certainly part of that. Mm. And the Gothic Revival is made better during the Victorian age because they have the industrial machines to be able to do all the crazy, you know, ornamentation. You have that Gothic ornamentation that's part of that deal. So now, saying all that, then you get the most popular styles in that period are Italianate, okay? Second Empire, and there's an Italianate house. Italianate houses are kind of identified by those brackets in the eave. Okay. So whenever you see brackets like that in an eave supporting that thing, it's usually Italianate.
So when you say brackets like that, you mean the things that look like they could be under like a plinth or like under like a fireplace mantle, like those brackets?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. That is a bracket. And so, and that is the eave. So,
I knew that. I was just asking for other
people. So I got that one right.
So brackets in the eave, right? And the way that those brackets are made, right? They're heavily ornamented and they're heavily detailed and they're kind of over the top. And the way they would have been made was that they've been made in scroll saws. They would have made with band saws. They would have been made in a shop, you know, put together very quickly and cheaply, made over and over and over and over and over again. And if you look at, you know, catalogs in the 1880s, 1890s, those brackets were all over the place. Nearly everything on that house would have been made in a mill shop, right? Would have been made and then shipped in to where it was going to be made.
So when you're saying made in a mill shop, that's just a reflection of the time. That's not necessarily a good thing or a bad thing. It's just they would have been started. They're not hand carved.
Yeah, made on site, hand carved by hand. I think, you know, we did a video and I don't know why it wasn't more popular than it was, because to me it was mind blowing. Okay. The house we did down in Granbury has a mantle in the house. Have I told you guys this before?
I don't think so.
Had a mantle in the house that was built in the house was an 1881 house, okay? These mantles were somewhat crude, okay? Mm-hmm. And then there was another mantle in there that was looked like a Victorian mantle. It was all quarter sawn oak. It was all, you know, these crazy details and, you know, typical of what you'd see in the catalogs. And basically what had happened was in 1881, when that house was built, the railroad wasn't there. 1887, I think the railroad gets there. And by 1890, they have this crazy new mantle in there. And so you're just like, you know, looking at, you know, pre-railroad, post-railroad, and the quality of building changes, the sophistication changes, the wood that they use changes. It went from paint grade to stain grade. I mean, it was just, It's still shocking to me. It's just like kind of blows my mind.
Some guy doing it there.
Totally. And look at the advancements that took place by, you know, flipping that switch, and all of a sudden it just opened this floodgate, and all this, you know, millwork came into the house that never would have been available before, showed up with that deal. So,
because it went from being completely inaffordable to where you'd have to like custom order those parts, and then all of a sudden it's accessible.
There is no ornamentation in the paint grade mantle, right? The guy either wasn't sophisticated enough or couldn't do it, right? Or it looks like a Greek Revival mantle. It looks like a mantle from a different period of time.
Interesting.
And so here we go. You know, the mantle on the left is kind of blocky. The moldings are simple. It's very simple. And then you have this mirrored, carved, quartersawn oak, two part, you know, with an overmantle mantle.
Right.
That is, would most likely have come with tile. That would have come from the manufacturer at the same time. Most likely would have come with a hearth, maybe even the insert. Right.
Wow.
Because this little switch has been flipped and you have the railroad dropping in. It's astounding to me. So
I think when we went there, I saw that in person.
Yeah.
I think I remember that.
Well, and I walked into that house knowing it is 1881, and I looked at that mantle, the oak one, and I was like, that's not right. That wouldn't have been here in 1881.
So you got rid of that then?
No, because what happened was what we found out was that the homeowner, the original homeowner, had been very proud of that mantle and had been like, it was a showpiece for them, which then I think tells a great story about home ownership at that time. Great story about, you know, just the excitement that people would have had about the availability of these new things that were available from the railroad.
Yeah, right.
And so, you know, the Sears catalog, the Montgomery Ward's catalogs were big deals that, you know, that people would look at. And, you know, I remember looking at the Sears catalog right when I was in the 70s. Right. Yeah. And so, but those catalogs would have been, you'd have been looking at, it would have been like looking at the, you know, the internet, and no one had the internet, right? It would have been like looking at an Amazon thing and just going, look at all this stuff. Look at all this stuff.
Yeah.
And so.
Oh, there's the mantle.
Yeah. Something very similar to it.
No, I think that's it.
Do you think there's people out there who, like, when, you know, you talk about flipping this switch and it opens up the floodgate for all this millwork and stuff. Are there people out there or where they're at that time that were like, well, this is not like pure craftsmanship because it's made on a machine. We like our stuff handmade. Or was there ever that stigma?
That's a great question.
I know you weren't there, but.
Well, you know, it's, I'll tell this, I'll answer that this way. There's one of the interesting things for my book, okay, is that you have steam planing mills in the 1840s. Okay?
What does that mean?
So steam powered. Mm-hmm. Okay. So, you know, the early industrialization starts in the late 1820s. There is a Woodworth molding plane that was patented.
Woodworth molding plane.
That was patented in the 1827, 1828. And it's a very famous patent case because they kept getting the patent extended. But that was basically the very first planing mill that basically got wood planing right, that you could put a board in one end and it come out the other end. Now, planing, right? And so those things were powered originally by water, okay, water mills, and then the steam-powered engine begins to get more and more powerful. I mean, I think they had a steam-powered machine in the, you know, late 1700s that would pump water out of a mine, right? And so they were very simple, like one horsepower. Yeah. They were just kind of getting water out of the way.
Yeah.
And so, you know, but the powerful machines that begin to take over. Well, you know, the other thing is that realize that in America we have a labor problem, really for a very long time. And so there are more sawmills in the United States than there were sawmills in England in the, you know, early 1800s, okay?
No way.
And they were all water-powered mills that were set up to saw boards in the United. Now, why were we figuring out ways to do sawmills in England? They didn't.
We have so much wood.
That we have so much
space
wood
too.
But there was no labor, like to pit saw lumber. Okay, you know what a pit saw is?
What is a pit saw?
Okay, pit sawing is basically that you have a hole in the ground, a pit. Mm-hmm. Okay, and they would basically set a board up over top, and there would be a guy in the pit and a guy above, and that's how they were. There's a pit saw. And that's how they would saw lumber, okay? And so now why would they do that? Well, they needed to cut the log down the center, right?
Yeah.
How else were you going to do that? You could lay it on the side, right? But
right.
This was easier.
You get
better
force. Oh, yeah, you could be standing up. Yeah. Yeah.
And so they
no need for the gym back then.
These were, that's how they pit sawed lumber.
That guy's ready for Thanksgiving.
And so, you know, you've That's got funny. It. If you're out in the woods and you're by yourself and you don't have sons, you don't have to pit saw, right?
You better have some sons.
Right? Yeah. The making of sawmills in America was kind of one of our it builds the American character and it builds the American, personality ideal, and ideal and stuff. And one reason why, and I was telling this to a podcaster, one reason why I think craft is really hard to establish in America is we've never really been about craft. Mm. We've always been about ingenuity. We've always been about speed. We've always been about, creativity, but it's not, we don't hold on to those old world ideas of craft and things like that, like the European countries do.
Yeah.
I was in Ireland, and we were driving around these very simple houses, and they all had a stone wall out front.
Yeah.
I was sitting there going, a stone wall? I go, why would they, let's just say they spent $300,000 on the house. They spent another 10 or 15 on the wall. I mean, it's just like, why would they spend that much? Well, because there was an ideal, there was an expectation for how they were going to build, how they're going to do things. And there is a expectation in Europe, my opinion, that that's the way you build quality things. They build more with stone than we do. They build, So long little rabbit trail there.
Here we are.
But it gets back to kind of what was, how we manufactured kind of what was going on. So if you think that the steam-powered mill starts in the 1830s, 1840s, by the 1870s, we have these very powerful mills, very powerful. I mean, one of the reasons in my book, I have a tough time calling it millwork as the title, is millwork is woodwork that's made in a mill, right?
Mm-hmm.
And before the Industrial Revolution, there is no millwork because you're not really making things in a mill.
Yeah.
And so I was sitting there, do I title the book woodwork and, pre-industrial woodwork and, post-industrial millwork? No. So anyway, it's...
it's funny. Do you have a title or not yet?
Right now it's millwork,
Okay.
It's 1740 to 1950, but... that's really not.
Would you say
accurate.
That
maybe you should call it millwork?
Would you say that someone who uses a plane like this and mills something by hand is that millwork?
So, no. Millwork would be with machines making things in the mill. Now, going back to your question, would people have looked at that and
looked
said anything?
Yeah.
Thank you for reminding me why I was blabbing on.
No problem.
What I've discovered the strange irony, in this book is that they start steam planing in the 1830s, 1840s, okay? So certainly by the 1870s, those modern mills that are growing up and are huge, and Curtis and Morgan and all the different ones that I've studied, they are making things by machine, just like that mantle, so fast and quick and everything else. So we're talking about hand planes. Do you know when the highest point of sales for hand planes is? 1890. And I'm sitting there going, why would people be buying a hand plane in 1890 when you can go pick it up off the shelf, right, just already made?
Wait, so that was right after they had made the really strong steam planers.
Yeah, it doesn't make sense. So your question, do you think the guys would have been saying, oh, this is a cheap way of doing it? I don't think so. I don't think that anybody was holding on to the hand plane. We've got to keep this tradition alive. I don't think anybody's doing that. But the highest point, the highest number of sales of hand planes is like from 1880 to 1920. Okay. And they're still making hand planes. Okay. The Sandusky hand tool company is still making molding planes in 1926. And I'm like, crazy. Who in the world's buying a hand? So, it's an interesting thing. And I think there's some generational stuff. There's a generation that, you know, let's say you're a 50-year-old guy like me and you're just learning the trade.
Right.
You're looking at me going, why would you hand plane? Hey, Grandpa, why would you hand plane that?
Yeah.
We can go get that from the lumber yard. Well, it's not the same shapes. You know, there's probably some habits. There's probably some things that,
right.
You know, there's also probably some speed that these guys learn. I've got a sheet in there. It's a flyer from 1848 mill shop in Brooklyn, Rome, and somewhere in New York.
Right.
And you know what? What do you think the savings is? I tell you that.
Oh, yeah.
It's like 20% savings or 20
versus by hand. Or
yeah.
Something.
Where I thought it would have been, you know, 300%.
So they were efficient.
They were efficient, right? And so that guy could actually make moldings pretty quick with those hand plane tools that we wouldn't be used to today because they were so fast. So the other thing that's happened is part of my theory is that, you know, if you think about America growing, you know, if you're in, you know, Fort Worth, Texas, in 1870 or 1880 when that house is being built, you're really on the frontier, okay?
Right.
Railroad isn't even here yet. You're in New York in 1880, and those guys are building mansions on Fifth Avenue, right? And so the disparity between what was available in Fort Worth and what was available in New York.
It was truly the Wild West.
It was probably Wild West.
Even from Fort Worth to Granbury.
For sure.
Crazy.
Yeah, I mean, how would you travel there? You know, you're on horse, and so the railroad wasn't even there. And so there's half the country, okay, not half the population, but half the country territory-wise that still needed hand planes because the power wasn't there yet.
That does make sense.
So it's just interesting kind of putting all that, you know, feeding that all into your brain, kind of going.
Yeah, because you originally said that, like, well, they're the most hand planes ever bought. And the obvious response to that is, okay, well, it looks like people didn't like the milled stuff. But then you start adding the extra context and you're like, maybe they did like the milled stuff.
Yeah, I think the general consensus is that the worker at that time loved what the machine was able to take off their hands. Okay. Yeah. If you've ever
like that.
Yeah. Exactly.
It's funny. If you got to a job site and you're like, all right, we need to start cutting boards to like start making something go. The first step is not let's lay that log down. The first step is we need to go dig a hole.
Oh,
I mean?
Yeah.
It's not just, yeah, that's crazy.
That hole's not there already.
Right.
And look how they lined that hole with logs so that it didn't collapse on them, didn't get wet. I mean, they've got to use that thing for a long time. So
I was thinking like the CNC, you know, kind of is something that people really hated, I feel like, when it first came out. And then now I feel like it's gotten more accepted. I wonder if it's kind of like that.
I don't think people hated the CNC when it came out. Guys like me did. But I think most people looked at it like, I know most people looked at it like, I can get rid of all my high paying salary guys because this thing's going to do all this work. And, you know, I told you that story about that company in Dallas that shut down because they did that.
Well, I guess I'm curious, do we think in today's day and age, like as things are coming out more and more, like what do we think the general consensus is on our stuff? Like we're talking hand planes versus like some of the stuff that's milled in the shop. We now mill things in shops, and like you're the guy who says we do it the way it was classically done. I mean, we're not, you know, hand planing every single one of the objects just because, one, it's not financially possible, but then two, I mean, there's a time and a place, right? Because there's Vossel who's doing it as well. So what do you think, or what do both of you guys think, as you're in the industry, has there been any new technology that's come along where people have been like, probably not going to be helpful, that is now helpful? I mean, other than CNC, CNC is a great example of it, but I feel like the CNC has taken something where it's like, you can't necessarily do, or the way that a CNC is going to work. I'll get there eventually, I promise. you know what I'm saying? Like where a CNC, it's like, you can't really replace everything about a CNC.
You're doing the Fred Armisen.
Yeah, I was thinking the same thing. I couldn't formulate it in my head. But you know what I'm saying? Where everything that a CNC can do, it's not like it can put a door together. It can't assemble pieces. Like there's obviously parts of it that aren't
possible. Well, I mean, if you go to the, probably one year we ought to go out to the AWS.
Yeah.
The woodworking show, basically, and they have all the tools out there, and these companies come in and set up their machines,
yeah,
and they're literally putting a rough board in one end and it's coming out a cabinet at the other end.
Are you serious?
Yeah. Now it's not like a cartoon where,
yeah,
it's like, but they have the machines lined up so that it goes through its thing, it goes through its shape,
like
it goes through its finish,
it's like a Dr. Seuss thing, yeah, just like bouncing around in there,
coming in and lifting it up.
Yeah, it's not that, but it is. There are, you know, you were saying, you know, you can't just make something from nothing. Actually, they can. They are.
Well, and what are your thoughts on something like that? Because, I mean, that's a, like, I guess I'm looking at this photo of the two mantles, right? And we've got these two mantles, one that was like hand done and then one that was milled in a shop and everything. And so that's a drastic change to what the status quo was into what it's not now. Is there anything in today's day and age that's been like that? Or?
I think it depends what problem you're trying to solve.
Okay.
Because I think that a lot of people will say, like when they look at our stuff, they'll say, well, you know, they're starving kids in Africa.
Well, like, what does that even mean? Basically, you can use the money that you're spending.
You can use the money
to
do something else instead of, and I'm just like, yeah, but it'll be ugly. And so, you know, so the problem that we're trying to solve.
Are you saying starving kids in Africa are ugly?
The problem that we're trying to solve is, you know, longevity, sustainability, and beauty. Okay. Mm-hmm. Historic precedent, classicism, all that stuff. The problem that a lot of those builders and a lot of the new manufacturers are trying to solve is speed and fast and cheap, right? And because housing affordability is bad, right? You know, and people want to make houses more affordable. Mm-hmm. So they're doing concrete printing. They're doing all these different things to, they're chasing after a different.
Is it an Amber Alert?
No, that's my wife. They're calling about. They're trying to solve a different problem,
yeah.
And so they end up.
That actually makes a ton of sense.
With products that are ugly, but they're not trying to solve the same thing that I am.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But there is a ton of new technology, a ton of new products every year. This new round of things that's going to solve and make the home building better. The problem is that those people that are trying to solve housing affordability. The, you know, custom builder finds it, goes, oh, that I can make that even cheaper. I'm going to save margin here. And all of a sudden, these custom builders start using products that are cheaper and cheaper and cheaper. Mm. And we end up with houses that are just ugly.
Right.
I am finding that the best thing about my YouTube videos is it's educating the homeowner. Mm-hmm. And and I'll have a lot of homeowners go, I had no idea. I can't believe this. And I had one today on YouTube saying, I can't believe that this insulated glass doesn't last very long and we're being forced to replace our windows every 15 to 20 years because the glass fails. Mm-hmm. And I was like,
the builders probably hate you.
And I was like, yep.
And they're like, Brent Hull told me this.
So
you gotta stop watching
in
that.
That Brent Hull guy.
You know that that's happening.
I think so.
You know that that's happening.
But that's good.
I was gonna say needs to happen. That also shines a light on, like, if someone's insecure about what they're telling people, it's like,
I bet it also happens that you're getting builders who are like the homeowners being like, look, I saw this video, and then they're watching and being like, oh, that's, I didn't know that. You know?
Yeah.
No, so you're probably going both ways.
Yeah, for sure. And there are builders who are saying, I appreciate you guys educating people out there, because it helps educating the homeowners the other way, right?
Helps
that you really ought to have something that's quality here.
I mean, yeah, I think I've been fighting for the homeowner, for the DIYer in the pod. Like, I think that's the cool audience that we get to speak to in this podcast as well, is like, because I don't know any of this stuff, but knowing this stuff or learning this stuff, I'm like, well, that makes a lot of sense. That's
so,
true.
I mean, we're this episode, we're supposed to be talking about Victorian.
Yeah, we're crushing it.
And so you you know, I wanted to give all that gorgeous background because I wanted to explain how these houses were made and what's going on there. Because just that whole sleuthing thing and looking at that mantle, you know, and understanding the handmade versus the machine made and the leap forward in, you know,
time. It's a literal time skip.
The leap forward of products that are available, of the shapes and the hardwoods. You know, mm-hmm. pre-industrial, almost everything is paint grade.
Wow.
Post-industrial, almost everything's stain grade. Mm-hmm. Because now we have powerful machines that can mill the bird's eye maple and mill the walnut and get the burling and get the other things that weren't available except to fine furniture makers before. And all of a sudden it's available, you know, cheap and readily accessible.
Was it really cheap or was it cheap like compared cheaper to someone making it?
Compared to someone
making
it.
It was still high end, like.
Well, I mean, you know, I think what I would do is I would look at what was being built at that time. And this house, you know, is definitely a very high end house. Mm-hmm. Whereas there's a lot of Victorian folk things. And you look at the products that are in those houses, they still have really big moldings. And you'll look at simple starter houses, folk Victorian houses, and they'll have 12 inch baseboards. You know, rosettes, you know, carved rosettes in the thing. They'll have, you know, reel moldings. They'll have things that you're like, I guess this is just readily available for everybody. And so,
that's what I would say would be
even a middle class house. There's houses that are even cheaper than that still have big moldings, that still have, you know, solid wood doors and things like that. So,
if we were going to build a house from the ground up, it's Victorian, what would we incorporate into that?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, that if you're building a, you know, farmhouse, like being asked to build a farmhouse right now for somebody, and they want a very traditional farmhouse, let's say with a budget and without a budget, right? And so they've got the money and they don't have the money. If they don't have the money, then you are probably getting, you know, salvage doors. Okay, I'm not I can't afford new custom doors. The new doors that are available are MDF or, you know, junk or whatever else. I would go after salvage doors. Probably try to find as much salvage as I could. Even a staircase and stuff like that would be that distinctive thing that would help that.
Do you think
deal.
There's a lot of salvage Victorian parts?
Yeah, a lot.
So is farmhouse Victorian?
A farmhouse can be Georgian, Federal, Greek Revival, Victorian, arts and crafts.
Oh, it transcends all styles, probably.
Well, only because farms are built during all those different periods, and they reflect that period of style that when they're built.
Oh, like even Palladio had a farmhouse, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, perfect. That's a great example. So wild. If I was building a Victorian today, I would have tall, thin windows. I would have, you know, I would have tall, probably 9 to 10 foot ceilings at least. Transoms over doors and windows.
What's a transom?
Transom is basically the little light above a door. We got transoms right there.
Yeah.
So that light over that door is a transom light over top. And so the hardware, you would want more decorative. Flooring would be probably something pretty simple, but it would be wide plank.
Would it be herringbone and stuff like that?
Well, in a nicer Victorian, it would. And so when you get into the nicer Victorian houses, right? Like
McFarland
over there, you know, the wood carpets, as they were called, they were basically rolled out and they were made in a factory and you'd roll them into the room and then put the base or trim around them. So, you know, even that little seating bench thing underneath the chair, that's right from the catalogs.
Really?
There are distinctive things that you'll see like that.
It's a giant raised panel in that thing.
Yeah, it is. Anyway. But, yeah. I mean, look at the expression of everything. Look at the brackets and the stairs, right?
The
rosettes, the raised panel molds on the doors, the corner beads, the size of the moldings, the fact that it's stain grade, you know, all, you know, the twisted balusters, right? I mean, you know, that's
I didn't even notice those.
Has to go through a machine. And so it's all, you know, been touched by the machine.
So mm-hmm. I guess going back to the mantles that you showed us, was that second one an example of a Victorian mantle and the first one was not?
Yes.
Okay. So then now,
but like,
so Victorian is just stamped by, it had to be machine made. And that's one of the bigger much. Things.
And it's see that like right under the shelf that uh-huh. you see that little dental or whatever yeah. that thing's going on. If you look around the mirror, that's an egg and dart molding. Uh-huh. But a lot of the times that ornamentation is cheap. Hmm. Like it's embossed. Because
they're just making, mm-hmm. oh, it's embossed.
Yeah,
oh,
wow. So they're actually taking a hot iron and pressing it into the mm-hmm. wood to make the egg and dart. And mm-hmm. so, as opposed to, you know, but there's also hand carving that takes place.
I feel like Victorian is like often, at least I think of it as like a very high style, very like, you know, wow, hoity-toity. And in a lot of ways, I would think that it would be a lot higher of a style if it was like hand done and it was, you know, all of these expressions were hand carved and all this other stuff.
Well,
am I missing that? Like, is that wrong?
No. I mean, you know, realize that there's a ton of immigrants coming into America at the time. And a lot of these mills had immigrants from old countries hired as craftsmen and carving. Like that yeah. mantle, that Ionic capital
yeah.
would have been hand carved. Hmm. Now they did have duplicarvers. Okay. Duplicarver is basically, you have yeah. a carved piece over here and basically a router that follows that thing and duplicates yeah. that carving. Okay. So they did have duplicarvers that could do that, but that would have been only in the really nice mills. But, you know, there's a lot of handwork that still goes into that mantle in particular right there. And so there, you know, if you look at the Biltmore estate, right, mm-hmm. that's probably the most famous Victorian house yeah. You know, it's chateau-esque, I think. A lot of old world craftsmen were brought over from you know, France and Italy and everything right. else to craft and do that millwork and do that work inside there.
Where is this located?
It's in North Carolina.
So cool.
And so, you know, these rooms and this kind of stuff, the plaster and all that kind of stuff yeah. would have been handcrafted, okay? And so, you know, there's an example of, you know,
oh my goodness.
Yeah. Over the top, but incredibly well crafted and stuff like that. So, you know, yeah. that those houses were, there was, and I think going back to the Victorian versus McMansion, mm-hmm. the thing that separates Victorians from McMansions is the handcrafting, mm-hmm. right? Is the skill level of the craftsmen in these houses was much higher because mm-hmm. why? Well, they could use hand tools, okay, hand planes, hand things, as well as the machines, right? And so they were, you know, that's when I talk about craftsmen today, there were things I want for Richard and I want for you. I want you to build and do as many things as possible mm-hmm. so that you are better, right? Mm-hmm. You are, Richard, I think, a better craftsman because you have built windows and doors, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, for sure.
You know so much more than just, you know, nail and trim to the wall. And so yeah. when you actually start crafting millwork as opposed to running trim, mm-hmm. you are better. And so...
So, I mean, one of the things I guess I'm hearing you saying is, like, it's not just, like, you can use the pre-made stuff, you can use the milled thing items. It's really about how you pull everything together, because if you're just taking, oh yeah, that was milled, that's great, take it and slapping it together, that's how you get the McMansion one. But when you actually have a fundamental understanding of what each of the roles that each of the pieces plays, and you can take those and tie them together into a story, it's good.
Yeah, I mean, and what I'm doing on jobs today is I am if you think about it as a computer program, mm-hmm. and that most lumber yards today have a library of moldings and yeah. a library of, you know, things that well, this is, you know, there's your moldings, and I look at those moldings and most of them are junk, right? I wouldn't mm-hmm. use 20%. I wouldn't use 80% of them. Right?
Yeah, I agree. I think 20% are decent.
Wow. that you can make use of, mm-hmm. okay? So, you know,
is that because the others are too simplistic, or what's the deal?
They're opposite. They're too over the top.
Yeah, they're either thin wow. and small, or they're just a bunch of bumps and bruises. They don't make sense anymore. Mm-hmm. And so I fixed a one of my Wednesday videos, I fixed this front porch on this Italianate house. And the what the builder had done before, okay, was basically used stuff that was available from the lumberyard. And so his capital ended up being a crown molding with a cap on the top. And that's what his that's what his capital looked like. And if you looked at the historic precedent of it, of what was there, it required a little bit more care. It's like if you were going to make it the capital of that column right there without the eye dental, you can't just run a piece of crown up there. You actually have to make those shapes differently. Right. And so that's where I would say, you know, the tools available to most carpenters today end up using, well, this is kind of close and I'll just put a 8/16 crown in there and, you know,
but it's not, you end up
with something that doesn't look right. And so when you say, you know, when you're asking your question, I'm just like, yes, but realize that most of the shapes aren't very good. And so I'm always looking to the past because I think that there are better examples of good stuff there than there are today.
And the 20% that I feel that are good from the lumber yards are just like the classics, like the bed mold and the little colonial.
If I was gonna, that's it. You know, I've done three molding collections for three different lumber yards. If I was, if the lumber yard was saying, you know, we want a collection of moldings, I would say go to the 1925, you know, Southern Yellow Pine molding catalog and copy that. Just use that, okay? And you'll get rid of most of the junk that's, you know, coming out today. It's just, you know, copying the past, looking at the past is, you know, a big deal. Yeah, so I think what we should do next time is actually talk about these different styles,
where
they
them.
Come from, why they are what they are, and then that will help people kind of start putting things together.
Sweet. I'll keep the questions down next time so we don't rabbit trail.
I feel like the rabbit trails were helpful here because
they're fun.
I think it established why the Victorian is what it is, and you know, helped you understand, because I think part of it is the why. It's not just seeing; it's understanding what was the mentality of the Victorian at that time.
Because I think that's one of the biggest things, we reference this a lot, but one of the things that differentiates Victorianism from McMansionism is the why, right? Because you've even said, like, McFarland could be considered a McMansion if you don't know what you're talking about. And it's like, yeah, I absolutely could think that. That's so easy. And even just hearing and seeing the history, like the railroad, knowing that America was so spread out, like all those things, like, it's all helpful. One final question on this, and then we'll wrap and we'll go to the next. But when we're talking Versailles, is that a Victorian house?
When was Versailles built?
You know, I don't know.
So it's like
1725.
It's like early 1700s.
Okay.
Yeah.
Versailles
was always a hunting thing, but Louis XIV made it into a. He moved the court out of Paris to Versailles, and it was a power move, and it was some other things. But he really made Versailles. You know, Louis XIV did.
And I might be totally wrong on this, but I was under the impression that like Versailles kind of set the pace for Victorianism. Is that wrong?
Well, I mean, I think you're looking at Versailles because it's so over the top.
Yeah, that's right.
It has some of that Victorian embellishments,
right.
You know, it's gold leaf, it's just heavily drawn.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I think you're looking at it and going heavily ornamented, over the top, you know, crazy. Hey, it's kind of the same as that Victorian house, right? And so, but they are, you know,
it's technically just good Greek Revival, right?
Versailles?
Yeah.
No. Versailles is not Greek Revival.
What is it?
Well, it's French. I mean, it's
La France.
It's typical French over the top crazy stuff that they did.
Okay.
Well,
that's helpful. But it was there earlier. They did a lot. It was French, but then it's not. It's too early.
If you look at this interior and you just glance at it really quick and don't look at it, that looks like a Victorian interior of some kind of a palace.
Well, especially with the top.
Yeah, so I understand what you're saying, but it's not.
That Biltmore thing is in Victorian?
It's late Victorian. I think it's 1890s. And so it's when they did that.
Because this looks like it could be in there.
Yeah,
it does.
So you see that European influence and, you know, look, Versailles has influenced a lot of different builders and a lot of different, you know, iterations. And so because the execution is so high, because it's so over the top, people can walk away. Well, I want to do that. Mm-hmm. I think it's an interesting comment on the human character of, you know, our desire in some cases to replicate this, to do this, to want to build like this. And whether it's pride, ego, you know, just want to, or whatever it is, there's something there.
Yeah. Well, that's fascinating. And that actually continues to help with trying to identify these things. Okay. Thanks for watching this episode. Sorry we didn't actually get to the full Victorian breakdown, but now you know why. And Simon Sinek says start with why. So thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time. Yeah.